Secondly, if an employer does not offer health benefits to employees, the workers could designate amounts to be withheld from their paychecks, along with taxes withheld from their paychecks. That's fair. These amounts would eventually be forwarded to insurers, let's say insurance companies, to pay premiums. Let's see now, that's two things for the insurance companies. Let's see what the third one says. The federal government could provide tax credits to low-income individuals and families or small businesses to help them pay for insurance. The full amount of the credit would be sent directly to the insurer. Four, Medicaid could be expanded, Medicaid, this is for the poor, to cover any adult with income below the official poverty level, about $9,600 for an individual. Each state would decide for itself whether to do this, and the federal government would provide financial incentive for states to take the option. In fact, what the government is now doing is reducing state grants on Medicaid, trying to move towards zero. Five, the federal government would offer small grants to states to help them establish insurance purchasing pools. Insurance purchasing pools. Individuals and small businesses could buy coverage through these pools. In other words, the whole thing is about buying insurance. Well, we can do that now. Okay?
You're listening to a public course by radical economist Doug Dowd, which he gives on a biweekly basis each spring and summer in San Francisco. This is the fourth lecture in the series. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue with Doug Dowd.
If I have any theme at all, and I have several, one of them is the irrationality of our society at all levels. Now, here's the employers, okay? General Motors, you know the trouble they're in. Ford, all the big automobile companies, all three of them. The steel companies, all the big companies, and the small companies that have been providing health insurance, partially, are in real trouble right now. Now, the trouble they're in is not as great as they say it is. In other words, it isn't like 50% or something like that. It's more like 6% of their costs. But still, if you're in General Motors and wondering whether you're going to go bankrupt, 6% is a lot of money when it comes to a couple of billion dollars. You would think that rational business people, and business people are supposed to be rational calculators like us consumers, you would think that they would start figuring out, or have maybe one guy, one person, one woman, one man in their office say, why don't you try to figure out what the difference would be to us if we were to go on putting in benefits for our workers, which cost us X, or had to pay increase our taxes, but no longer have to pay those benefits. Increase our taxes to the federal government for a program. There would be an increase in taxes, let's say, maybe. Although there might be a decrease in taxes because the present system is so inefficient. But let's say that our taxes would go up and our benefit costs would go down. If they would figure it out rationally, they would know that their benefit costs would go down much more than their taxes would go up. You understand? Because their benefit costs are for their own group of people, okay, which are getting very good benefits, or used to. And the taxes, they're going to get a tiny percentage for them, of the taxpayers. They're paying all the, quote, tax for their workers. But if they paid taxes for a universal program, they'd be only one of the people paying taxes out of millions. Okay? Millions of companies, incidentally. So they're really stupid. You don't find, incidentally, in Italy, you don't find any big company saying, we want to privatize the health care, the health insurance system. None of them says that. Now, one of the ways in which they pay for these things in Italy is through cigarette taxes, which are very high, and gasoline taxes. You think gasoline costs a lot here? It costs two or three times as much in Italy. Okay? Two or three times as much. And it's deliberate. It's a way of collecting taxes. Now, it happens to be a regressive tax, okay? as it's called a value added. They use the value added tax, which is a flat tax. And it's regressive because people on the bottom level are paying more as a percentage of their income in taxes. But at least they're getting something for it. But in any case, there are also income taxes. So let me turn to prescription drugs, which is part of the problem. In Italy, you go to a doctor, you go to the hospital, whatever, and if you're in the hospital, they give you the drugs. When you leave the hospital or when you're seeing your doctor, and I incidentally go to a doctor whenever I want to, the same doctor, I've been going to him for 20 years, and if I need a prescription, he gives me a prescription. I go to the pharmacy, and I pay something for it. If I were poor, I wouldn't pay anything, but I pay 10%, okay? I might say, incidentally, parenthetically, you remember the flu epidemic last year? Well, I get a flu shot there every year, so I know what it costs. And while I was getting my flu shot, and there was no shortage of flu stuff, vaccine in Italy, there was just a shortage here. While I was getting, I was reading my New York, my International Herald Tribune about what was going on here. Many people couldn't get it at all. Some people were paying $150 for it, but the average price was $60. I was paid $8 for mine. And all I had to do was walk across the street to get it. I didn't have to stand in line. And Italy's a backward country, as everyone knows, in all respects, especially healthcare. In that new Medicare bill that was passed, there was a provision for pharmaceuticals. I don't know how many of you are on Medicare. I am, and I get all the stuff from them, okay, all the literature from them. Now, I'm a professor, okay? I cannot understand what the hell they're talking about. It says you do this, that, and the other thing, A, B, C, D. You go on 5 or 6, 7 or 8 pages of this stuff. My mother was on Medicare. Her sister, my aunt, was on Medicare. They didn't know what the hell was going on about anything. But these things that the government puts out, and they're as complicated as they are for one reason. Special interests are demanding that they be protected in this, that, and the other respect, and there are just lots and lots of special interests. And the pharmaceutical companies are among the most powerful. The 10 biggest pharmaceutical companies in the year for which they were, Fortune magazine was putting out the numbers, I think it was last year, receive more in the way of profits than the other remaining 490 Fortune 500 largest companies. They both get about $33, $34 billion. 10 companies in profits. Profits being made out of pharmaceuticals, not out of booze, not out of marijuana, which now you can't smoke, now you can't get in the hospital. The Supreme Court, did you know that, just said you can't get that for medical purposes anymore. The pharmaceutical companies are the most profitable of all companies. There's something obscene about that. Obscene. It's mass criminality. Because if people don't get the pharmaceuticals they need, they get less and less well, or they die, and or they die. There's something so awful about that. And the American public is so convinced that we have the best program in the world. The bill's provisions presumably reduce patients' outlays for prescription drugs. But to take advantage of them, one must also participate in the first stages of the privatization of Medicare, Medicaid, and also thus of Social Security, which is linked to Medicare. And I can assure you, friends, Social Security and Medicare are both going out the window in time. That's the aim. Right now, they're up at the window and being pushed. Within 10 years, unless the politics of this country change, there won't be any. Milton Friedman will have had his way. Okay. The drug coverage, I'm now quoting an article, is puny. For an estimated $420 annual premium, you have to pay for this, you understand? You have to pay to get this privilege. You pay $420 if you're an oldie. For an estimated $420 annual premium, seniors will get a policy that requires them to pay $3,600 of the first $5,100 of their drug expenditures. Beyond $5,100, Medicare pays 95%. Well, you may have died before you get there. You have to pay $3,600. Now, if you're the average old person, Where are you going to get that $3,600? Because you're getting Social Security, okay? If you're the average old person, and I'm not, but I get Social Security, and I know what I get, okay? And I get about $1,300 a month from them. Times 10 is 13,000 plus. So it comes to about 12,000, 14,000 a year, okay? That's what I get from them. But I also get other pensions, okay? My mother took in $1,100 a month. Her sister took in less than that. Her sister practically got nothing, my Aunt Mary, because she never worked for anybody. She ran a gambling joint in the Tenderloin, and she wasn't. When I was about 14 years old, I used to go down to the gambling joint after school just to watch what was going on. It was horses and poker. And one afternoon I was there, and it was down in the Tenderloin. The doorbell rang. She says, "Douglas, go see who's at the door." And I went to the door. There was a cop at the door. I slammed the door. I said, "Mary," I said, "there's a cop at the door." "Oh," she says, "Douglas, give the nice man this envelope." So I went and gave him the envelope, and I came back. I said, "What was that, Mary?" She says, "Douglas," she said, "you know, we all have to pay taxes. Some people pay them this way, and some people pay them that way." Anyhow, she never got much Social Security because she never had an income. That's where I learned the difference between dishonesty and dishonorable. She was a very honorable person, but really dishonest. So suppose you're the average old person, and you have maybe you're lucky, maybe you have $1,200 or so that you picked up, and incidentally, you get in proportion to what you put in, of course. So the poorer you were, the less you get. The richer you were, the less you need it, the more you get. I shouldn't be getting anything to live comfortably. I don't need it. People who would use it one night going to a hotel, who are millionaires, about which we will get some more information later on, not now. It's just obscene. The need of the average old person, unless they happen to be lucky enough to be living in a home they owned and paid for, and not the average is not doing that, the need is not met by twice what they're getting for Social Security. And as you get old, and again, I'm lucky again, I'm 85 years old and healthy as most of you in this room, except I'm losing my voice, little problem here, little problem there, this sort of thing, but still, I go biking every day, okay? I stand up and talk all the time. I'm unusual, lucky in health, among other things. But by the time most people get to be 70, 75, 80, they are not that well off in terms of health. They've got a string of medications in front of them all the time, if they can buy them. They're worried about something all the time, all the time, all the time, with good reason. They need hospitalization, they need doctor's visits, they need this, they need that. Where's it going to come from? So they don't get it. That need is not met in this country. And if there's any group of people besides the old who needs health care most because of the way they live, it's the poor. Because they don't eat well enough. They don't house well enough. They haven't been treated well enough from birth. And they really need health care. And they're the ones that get the least of it. The only chance they've got is to go to emergency, and they've been closing down emergency rooms in this country for the past 20 years. In L.A., the biggest hospital in L.A. was closed down entirely. And it was what was serving the poor people. And it's the same everywhere in this country. How could we put up with this? A better question, how can we change it? Incidentally, in this class, and she's not here this evening, is Frances Payne. And Frances is perhaps undoubtedly more than anyone else in this room, and more than almost everybody else in this city, is very much involved in the San Francisco Healthcare Project. And I was hoping she'd be here this evening so she could say something. So if she's here next time, I'll have her speak next time. Well, Frances was a nun, Catholic nun. And she went to Bolivia, not because she was radical. She just went there because it was the sort of thing where she was sent. She got down there when there was a revolutionary movement going on. She got herself involved in the revolutionary movement. She stopped being a nun. It's like Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan, both of them blood friends of mine, whom I loved dearly. Frances became part of the liberation movement down there, a movement I wish we had here. Just as Dan became Father Berrigan of the Catonsville Nine, people know that. People wanted, burned up all the draft cards, had the police and newspaper people come and watch them do it. Dan was the chaplain at Cornell, where I was teaching. And the way he got there was because they sent him first, the church, when he got his Jesuitness, they sent him first to France. And he got mixed up with the workers' movement in France. So they sent him to Latin America. Get rid of him. He got mixed up with liberation theology down there. We'll show him. They stuck him as a chaplain in a f***ing university, Cornell. Well, so happens that Cornell was probably the hottest place in the whole country at that time. And Berrigan and a bunch of the rest of us there had a very good time, very good career together. He's still alive. Phil went to prison. Dan was supposed to go to prison, but he went underground. I loved Dan Berrigan so much, I almost go queer for him, which he wouldn't mind, incidentally. When they went underground, Dan and another one of the nuns, one of the things that had to be done was to find places for them to hide underground. So a little group was created called the East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives. And one of the nuns in that, a woman named Sister Liz, married Phil Berrigan, who was in prison at that time. They caught him. But I was one of the people who was trying to hide Dan. And so I got to know those people very well. When Dan was underground, while he was still underground, we had a thing at Cornell, which was an anti-war protest, in which a group of people did things on the stage. They came out in great, they were all encased in great big cardboard things and sang and so on. I forget what they called themselves. They were very well known in the 60s and the early 70s. So they had this big thing at Cornell to raise money and so on. And out of one of these great cardboard things stepped Dan Berrigan. And in the audience were FBI men, and we knew there were FBI men in the audience. And out of the audience, there's Dan Berrigan up on the stage, and he gave a quick speech, and he ran like hell and got away because the audience blocked the FBI people because they couldn't chase him. But so these people who become nuns and priests, some of them are pretty good people. I am myself, I find it very difficult to believe in anything religious except ethics, but some very, very good people. Well, how did I get in on that anyway? How did I get started on that?
Frances.
So she got all involved in that down there, and then she married a guy who was very much involved in Bolivian politics, and now they both live in San Francisco. And Bolivia just said past week to the United States, up yours, Buster. And that's what's happening in Latin America. That's the time for another discussion, what's happening in the United States and the world. So, I'd like to have some discussion is what I mean. Any questions? Yes, Butler.
It's an observation, and I'm sure you can fit it in, but the corporate leaders are now being pretty rational with the health care plans because they're just dumping their pensions on the government.
Oh, so, yeah.
They don't have to worry about it anymore. It's just more.
That's the pensions. Wealth. That's the pensions. But I'm talking about health.
The pensions include the health benefits.
Yeah. So the pension guarantee, the pension benefits guarantee thing is itself getting ready to go bankrupt, incidentally.
I have a question. You were mentioning that people with political power and financial power in this society, maybe the world, are bad. They're bad people. They're doing bad things to everyone. Is that a rule that those that rise are bad, or is it because the people that they come from are bad?
Well, there's an old saying, power corrupts. Uh-huh. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That was said in the 18th century. But it isn't that power corrupts, it's seeking power corrupts. And power, seeking wealth, seeking power are very much the same thing in a capitalist society.
It's the system that makes the people do right.
The system, as Veblen once argued, and Veblen is the name of that dog too, and he would agree with everything I'm going to say now. Veblen argued, I think this is a very important thing to think about and worry about and do something about for yourself. Veblen, in a book of his called The Instinct of Workmanship, and I'm very much a descendant of Veblen and of Marx, and Veblen was a friendly critic of Marx. He argued that the instinct of workmanship, this is something the species survived because of it, okay? And he also said that the species survived because of the parental bent, which is taking care of, okay? And by parental bent, he really meant the maternal bent, not the paternal bent. But then he said that these instincts, use the word instinct with quotation marks around it, these powerful tendencies in us that lead us to survive through, to subsist by working with the land, with hunting and so on, hunting, all this kind of thing originally, can be thought of as constructive. But there are destructive tendencies in us also. And he, in his usual ironic way of talking about things, classified these as the instinct of sportsmanship, by which he meant competition and rivalry, in which we have these two warring tendencies or two conflicting tendencies at work in us as an instinct. Because the instinct of sportsmanship, or to put it differently, the instinct of competition is also part of survival, in the sense that the hunting part of the hunting and gathering and the defending yourself against others who are also desperate is a way of surviving. But he argued that whether one set of tendencies, and it's a complicated set of tendencies on both sides, prevails or the other, depends upon the social process within which people are living. And if there's anything, any generalization I would tattoo on my breast, if I were ever to be tattoo anything, it would be that capitalism brings out the worst in us. It could not exist or survive, let alone thrive, unless it brought out the worst in everyone. And this is what Marx was talking about when he talked about alienation. The alienation Marx is talking about is the alienation of human beings from Veblen's instinctive workmanship and parental bent. In this society, most especially in the United States, it isn't that Italy, and Italy is incidentally is better than I think most of the European countries in this respect, but it isn't as though the United States is alone in these kinds of things. All the capitalist countries suffer from this kind of thing, and some of the countries that are not capitalist too. I mean, what's wrong with society is not just a function of capitalism. It's just that capitalism encourages it more than other societies. And it's so unnecessary. But when it comes to competition, for example, I mean, one of the things that makes me sick in my head and body is what's happening in education now, where competition is taking over. My daughter teaches elementary school, and she loves kids. She loves teaching, and her heart is breaking because of what she has to do in the way of tests and what she's not allowed to do because of rules and so on, so on, so on, so on. And she doesn't want to teach communism or socialism or anything like that. She just wants to let the children find their possibilities. Competition is something that's in, I was going to say it's inbred. I don't mean that genetically. Socially, it's inbred in us. And that's what Veblen, when he used instincts, he was talking about socialized tendencies. You can hardly get through a day, if at all, without you, all of us in this room, having some kind of a competitive stir in you about something. Whether it's going to a movie and having to stand in line, whether it's going to a restaurant, whatever we do, we're competing with others. We aren't necessarily, we don't have to, but we have this tendency to look at other people as competition for the same thing. Not always. Not all people. But all too often. It's just natural in us. It's a kind of a sickness in us. And we're not even conscious of it. That's what Veblen was talking about. We're not even conscious of it. So, if you have any talent at all in our society, I'm still trying to deal with what you're talking about. If you have any talent at all, any brains, any rhythm, any this, that, or the other thing, you naturally think of using that talent to get ahead, which is almost always a competition with somebody else, and quite often at the expense of someone else.
It starts way back in preschool, early childhood education.
Oh, yeah.
They force these little four-year-olds to learn something if they take a test instead of socialize.
When I went to grade school, I was very tall then, and I was skipped 5 times in grade school. Skipped classes, you understand? Because I was so tall. So I missed an awful lot of stuff. I never learned arithmetic. I never learned anything. And then I got to high school, and I flunked a lot of kinds of things. And when I finally wanted to go to college, I had to go to junior college in order to make up all this kind of stuff. And I never was any good at certain kinds of things because I'd never learned math, for example. I'm just terrible, even at simple arithmetic. I'm very terrible because I didn't learn it, and then I got a thing about it. You understand? I'm not a great intellect or anything like that, but here I am able to read and write and teach and read and board. You know, I'm not a Dummkopf. I'm an educated person, but pretty much self-educated. Helped along at the university by the time I finally got in because there just happened to be three or four professors there who were really good people, okay? And then most of the stuff I learned having been prodded to do that learning after I got through with the university. I know that I could not get into a university today, given the education I had before when I got into the university. You understand? I couldn't get in. I couldn't get through those tests at all. I might say that when I did go to the university, well, I was in the Army for 4 years. I got out at the end of the war, and in the spring of 1946, I tried to get into Berkeley, and I got in. Okay, they gave me 2 years university credit. And here's a kid who skipped 2.5 years of grade school. Okay, no school. Then they took away 2 years of university work for me because I'd been in the Army and I'd learned so much in the Army. I was a pilot. They said, well, if you're a pilot, you must have studied navigation, you must have done this, you must have done this. All bullshit. What you do is you learn how to stay alive. It's all you do, you know, if possible. And I never learned anything about navigation, schmavigation. I don't even know how to spell the word. They gave me 2 years, so I started out as a junior. I graduated 2 years later, you know, and then I went on to graduate work. And all this was all the... Now, I know I'm bright enough, you know, and so on, but nevertheless, wonderful if you're lucky. Not so wonderful even if you're lucky, because there was a lot lost in the process and so on. But the testing thing doesn't really... It's the opposite of what we should be doing with kids, which is to get the kids in a room or someplace, a field, and just give them the opportunity to learn, to read, to feel, to know, to be. Of course, all these kids have parents who are also have been socialized to crush rather than to nourish. My daughter teaches in Watsonville. She teaches migrant workers' kids, bilingual. She's bilingual. She has to be. They're all poor kids. Their parents, she's also a family therapist. She has a degree in family therapy. She does her family therapy with the parents of the kids. She's paid for it by the state. So these kids don't have a chance. Their parents are deep trouble all the time. The kids come, so all the kinds of things that so she has to test them. They can barely speak English. She's trying to teach them English. They won't even accept. It's just the whole thing. It's as though we were trying to do everything we can to destroy possibility for people. And it starts with kids. I'll talk about education later, but that's. So that's what you get for asking the question. These old guys really drive me crazy. Yes. At least you've got hair.
I had a thought.
It's about time, Lou.
Yeah, it was not a very long thought. But, you know, the left is very eloquent about the
deficiency and criminality of capitalism. But I don't hear people talking much about models or visions for something more positive. And I'd like to know what you think about what are positive models that are being developed or...
We can talk about that at length, say next time or sometime soon. But all I would say is this: in the first place, I think that the answer has to be in part determined by where you are. Let's see, are you here? Are you in Italy? Are you? Because everywhere's got something horribly wrong with it. Okay, Italy included, China included, everyone. But the United States, we have a very special question. So you have to answer that. I have to answer that question because I'm speaking to people in the United States. But I don't mean just you people. I mean we have to. If we're going to have, first place, we need a movement which represents all the efforts to all the needs that are not fulfilled that needs to be fulfilled, the ones that are the basic needs I'm talking about, which include the opportunity and so on. We have to have a movement, a cooperative movement, not what we have now, a bunch of segments that are competing with each other for funds and time and effort and so on. We have to see ourselves as Marx once said, and the educators too need educating. Okay? We have to see ourselves as needing to learn more if we're going to be able to do anything well. Okay? This doesn't mean that we have to understand our society much better than we do. That includes the guy who's saying that right here now. Okay? Everyone. Everyone has to understand, we have to try to understand, why are our people so inert? Why are they so apathetic? Why are they so easily boonswoggled?
But so many people seem to understand that already, but they have no vision that allows them to move cooperatively with other people. That seems to be...
Well, I think we have to, the program in the first place. Every book I've written, and you've read some of them, there's the suggestion along these lines that you're talking about. But I think that we just really have to understand, first and foremost, that people... I would say a basic needs program is the first thing. But the second, to have as the content of what you're going to be working for. I would also say that in this day and age, in this country, we also have to make it very clear that we must work for peace. We must make our society less militaristic or non-militaristic. We must work to save nature. In other words, we must have a comprehensive program, which we can't talk about in 4 or 5 minutes. But we can talk about it some other time. But then we also must... We must, the people who are already at this level, so to speak, of engagement and caring, must find, for each of us, we must find the next step so that we become involved with groups that are trying to do something, however inadequately they may be doing it. But there must be a movement that is explicitly based upon the fact that American people are having themselves harmed by the ongoing processes, and that there is a decent alternative, a set of decent alternatives, in which everyone except a handful will be better off. The people who won't be better off are criminals, up at the top. Now, that's I hate to give that kind of an answer in this kind of time. Okay, well, there's no time to talk. But this is something that in this group, before we part, we should spend a whole evening talking about this. Okay, let's say the last two meetings or something. So I think we got to go now.
That was economist Doug Dowd from his ongoing public class lecture on economics and society, a yearly free course he gives in San Francisco. We're airing his biweekly class lectures throughout the summer. For more on Doug Dowd's work, visit dougdowd.org, dougdowd.org. We'll conclude the program with an essay by economist Michael Hudson that sheds light on the administration's motives in so-called Social Security reform. Hudson is Distinguished Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and the author of many books on international and domestic finance, including Superimperialism, The Origin and Fundamentals of U.S. World Dominance. This essay is titled, Why Social Security Won't Be Enough to Save Wall Street. Hudson writes, Social Security, formerly the third rail of American politics, has now been trod upon in a rather dramatic fashion by George W. Bush. Given that the maneuver is both stupid and unnecessary, one must ask why. After all, the program's alleged deficiencies, if there are any, will not manifest themselves until at least 2018. This is not quite the same as worrying about the sun's eventual collapse into a black hole, but for most politicians, a problem that lies 13 years in the future is nearly the same thing. Clearly, all is not what it seems. Bush himself offers two reasons for the present boldness. The first, that Social Security is, quote, in crisis, is easily dismissed. Government actuaries, backed by economists from across the political spectrum, insist there is no funding problem. The Social Security Administration will take in more money than it pays out for the next 13 years. It has built up a reserve of $1.8 trillion in interest-bearing treasury bonds for the years after that, and any later shortfall can be covered easily by even a partial rollback of the recent tax cuts for the rich. Bush's second argument sounds more promising. If the American people will simply follow his plan, he says, they too will become rich. The way the system works now, the government withholds 12.4% of your paycheck, up to $90,000 in annual income. In return, it promises to provide you a monthly payment, a pension, from the time you turn 62 until the time you die. As of this writing, the administration's alternative remains somewhat nebulous. But what is clear in all of the variations presented thus far is that you will be able to put some of your paycheck into the stock market. Bush calls these stock purchases personal savings accounts. Vice President Dick Cheney described the benefits of these personal savings accounts in January. His example was a young woman who put away $1,000 every year for 40 years. The Social Security Administration currently puts her money into Treasury bills, which at present return about 2%. So in 40 years, that investment would have returned about $61,000. Not too bad. But if she invested the money in the stock market, Cheney said, earning even at its lowest historical rate of return, she would see more than double that amount, $160,000. If the individual earned the average historical stock market rate of return, she would have more than $225,000, or nearly four times the amount to be expected from Social Security. That's a lot of math. Cheney's main point is that an upbeat assessment of the stock market, about 7.5% annually over 40 years by his reckoning, would easily exceed the 2% offered by Treasury bills. There's no arguing that $225,000 is more than $61,000. On the other hand, it's not as if you get a lump sum from the Social Security Administration when you retire. The woman Cheney cited could end up taking in much more than $61,000 if she lives long enough. The average annual payment to retirees today is about $11,000. That is $11,000 per year. Or she could die on her 62nd birthday. Like any other investment or any other form of insurance for that matter, Social Security is somewhat of a gamble. But then, so is the stock market. By Cheney's estimation, however, today's stock market is a much better bet. Over time, he concluded, the securities markets are the best, safest way to build substantial personal savings, close quote. That's the argument, anyway. The stock market is the main chance in America, and Bush wants to let all of us in on the action. The one sure mark of a con, though, is the promise of free money. In fact, the only way the stock market is going to grow is if we, the people, put a lot more of our money into it. What Bush seeks to manufacture is a boom, or more accurately, a bubble, bankrolled by the last safe pile of cash in America today. His plan is a Ponzi scheme, and in that scheme, it is Social Security that is being played for the last sucker. Retirement savings are by far the most important source of money on Wall Street. The Federal Reserve Board reports that public and private retirement accounts, not including Social Security, had assets of $10 trillion by the end of 2003. Nearly half of that, $4.7 trillion, was held in stocks. By way of comparison, the total value of all domestic stocks listed on NASDAQ, the American Stock Exchange, and the New York Stock Exchange at the end of 2003 was about $14.2 trillion. In the past, few retirement dollars found their way to Wall Street. IRAs and 401ks had yet to be invented, and few companies offered private pension plans of any kind. In 1950, General Motors, then as now, among the largest employers on Earth, began to change that with a new form of compensation. The company would withhold money from paychecks, much like the Social Security Administration was doing, and add money of its own to build up a reserve to pay retirees many decades into the future. Generally called a defined benefit plan, the scheme guarantees retirees a specific defined monthly payment until they died. Other giants of American industry soon followed, and the funds grew quickly. In most of them, at least half the money was put into the stock market. Workers would thus gain, at least in theory, a stake in the prosperity of their company, building loyalty to management while also providing companies with a captive source of credit, their own workforce. All of that ripe cash returned to fuel the bull market of the 1950s. Management philosopher Peter Drucker called this process pension fund socialism and hailed it as the most productive social development of the 20th century because it would at last merge the interests of labor and capital. Louis O. Kelso and Mortimer J. Adler even wrote a book called The Capitalist Manifesto, announcing that a new epoch of harmony between workers and owners was at hand because soon all the workers would be owners. It didn't quite work out that way. Many companies used retirement reserves to buy their own stocks, bidding up their share price and allowing them to take over other firms on favorable terms, especially as mergers and acquisitions gained momentum in the 1960s. The problem was that when companies went bankrupt, especially small firms, the collapse also wiped out the pension funds invested in those companies. Employees of such companies found themselves not only out of work, but stripped of the money they thought was being saved for their retirement. Congress moved to limit such behavior by obliging corporate pension funds to be run by an arm's-length trustee, although workers were still permitted and often encouraged to keep the pensions in the stock of their employees. To further protect workers, Congress created the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the PBGC, in 1974. All corporate pension plans were required to buy federal insurance through the PBGC to protect workers in the event of a failed investment scheme or corporate bankruptcy. The plans themselves were still prone to risk, but at least the pensions would be backed by the government and workers could feel secure about their retirement. Most companies now offer their employees a broad array of mutual funds instead of just their own stock. In itself, this is good common sense investing practice, and it also protects fund managers from charges of scheming. The other result of this practice is that workers' fortunes are now tied not just to their own companies, but to the market as a whole, which is where and how we come both to the problem and the scam. While fears regarding the solvency of Social Security are unwarranted, many corporate pension plans, the ones that have been so important in bankrolling the stock market rise of the past few decades, are themselves threatening to go bust, taking their parent companies down with them. The financial rot has already begun to seep into the airline and steel industries, and the auto sector may be next. General Motors reports that its current pension obligations add $675 to the cost of every vehicle it produces. The shortfalls aren't just a matter of bad luck. For quite a few years now, companies simply haven't been putting away enough money to pay retirees what they are owed. The PBGC estimates that the underfunding of traditional defined benefit plans, for instance, deepened by $100 billion last year to a total of $450 billion. The problem was created by fund managers and CFOs who believed, or at least pretended to believe, that pension reserves would grow at fantastic rates of return forever. Milliman USA, a benefits consulting firm, reports on the assumed rates of return on pension investments at the 100 largest firms in America. How high did these companies bet? In 2000 and 2001, the median projected rate of return was 9.5%. In 2002, it was 9.25%. And in 2003, it was 8.55%. These are wildly optimistic projections, even by Dick Cheney's standards. Last summer, the Financial Times noted that they conflict not only with present reality, but with warnings from such mainstream investment experts as Peter Bernstein, Jeremy Siegel, and Jeremy Grantham that, quote, we have entered a low-return environment. And that as a result, many investors are expecting long-term returns closer to 7% or 5%. Even these rates seem overly exuberant, given that the top 100 corporate pension funds earned an average annual investment return of just 1.3% between the end of 1999 and the end of 2003. At the beginning of 2001, for instance, IBM proposed that it would earn $6.3 billion on pension fund assets of $61 billion, about 10%. This was an astonishing demonstration of confidence, given that IBM had earned only $1.2 billion on those assets the previous year. IBM actually went on to lose $4 billion in 2001. Barely daunted, the company's managers predicted a 9.5% return in 2002. They lost another $7 billion. In 2003, they predicted a return of $6 billion. And as the market began to recover, they at last beat their prediction by $4.4 billion. The result of this, quote, recovery is that since George W. Bush took office, IBM's pension fund assets have plummeted by more than $1 billion. Nonetheless, corporate fund managers across America remain optimistic. Such errors in judgment are seldom accidental. In pretending that their funds could generate high returns, managers sought a real, albeit short-term, advantage. The faster companies projected their funds to grow, the less they had to set aside to pay their retirees. The lower set-asides, in turn, allowed them to report higher earnings, thereby driving up the price of the company's own stock to, quote, create shareholder value. Faced with a choice between living up to their pension promises or reporting higher net earnings, companies simply decided not to live up to their employee agreement. The practice is not one that can be sustained across 40 years. It is a kind of Ponzi scheme, in which present profits are paid for by the promise of future stock market gains. At some point, retirees are going to want the money they are owed. The last few years have seen the results of these broken promises in the form of lawsuits, bankruptcy, and ultimately retirees being forced to live on far less than they were promised. In the end, it is the PBGC that pays when the plans go bust. Here, however, the problem deepens considerably, because picking up the total bill for the corporate sector's underfunding would bankrupt the PBGC itself. Last November, the PBGC reported that although it had operated for several years with virtually no claims, close quote, the end of the stock market boom has given way to a, quote, period of record-breaking claims. As recently as 2001, the PBGC had a surplus of $8 billion, but a series of bankruptcy cases pushed it $23 billion into deficit last year, a year in which it took in only $1.5 billion in premiums. The PBGC would need more than 15 years just to make up its current deficit, with new claims arriving all the while. It has proposed that companies follow more realistic accounting rules and pay premiums that reflect the true risks of their underfunding. It also is asking for stricter limits on the ability of companies to escape their pension debts by declaring bankruptcy. Without such changes, the PBGC will be forced into bankruptcy, and the government will have to bail it out. That could cost as much as $95 billion, according to the Congressional Research Service. At that point, only today's profits would remain private. The losses will have been fully socialized. Barring some sudden influx of capital, something has to give, either the hope of retirees or the hopes of the stock market. Unfortunately, this is a zero-sum game in which many Americans are on both sides at once. Higher pension set-asides will diminish corporate earnings. Lowered earnings, in turn, will lead to dividend cuts and job losses. Low dividends and high employment will decrease the demand for stocks, leading to further declines in the ability of pension funds to pay retirees, with more defaults all around. Workers, retirees, investors, and taxpayers thus find themselves yoked to the fortunes of the financial managers who created this situation. This is hardly the kind of happy pension fund socialism that Peter Drucker had in mind, in which worker owners share risks and rewards alike as they create the goods and services demanded by a thriving marketplace. In fact, what has happened is that companies have made a great effort not merely to share the risk, but to offload it entirely onto the backs of their employees, the government, or taxpayers in general. This phenomenon of risk rolling downward can be seen most clearly in the move by many companies from defined benefit programs in which employees are guaranteed a specific retirement payment based on their salary history to a defined contribution plan in which workers know nothing else except how much is being deducted from their paychecks. The payout rate is decided by how well the stock market performs, which shifts the risk onto employees even as it frees up more revenue for their employers and generates rich commissions for money managers. The risk flows down the economic scale even as the cash flows up. Given the widespread problems confronting pensions outside the embrace of the federal government, now would seem an odd time for the administration to campaign for Social Security privatization. Why would anyone want to invest America's last line of pension defense in so perilous a market? Are Bush and his advisors unaware of the odds? Probably not. Therefore, they must have a particular idea in mind. Presumably, they believe that some kind of market recovery is needed, not only to rescue the PBGC, but to rescue the pension funds, to rescue the stock market, and for that matter, to rescue the political fortunes of the ruling party. What is needed, in fact, is a Bush boom. After all, such a boom would allow us to, quote, grow our way out of trouble, close quote, as we have done so many times before. But where will the funds come from to bid up stock prices? The national savings rate is nearly zero, because most personal discretionary income, like that of most companies, is absorbed in repaying debts. Previously, the Fed could have flooded the capital market with credit to lower interest rates and thereby spur a bond and stock market bubble. But interest rates are the lowest since the 1950s. They can go no lower. There is only one place to turn. The new flow of funds into the stock market will have to come from labor itself, just as it did back in the 1950s. Social Security is the greatest plum of all, so large as to virtually guarantee a boom. Talk of bubbles has become popular in recent years, but most discussions miss the key point. Although optimism is inherent in the human spirit, it rarely effervesces into a kind of frenzy necessary to float a bubble without help from the government. In fact, many of history's most famous bubbles have been sponsored by governments in order to get out of debt. Britain, in 1711, persuaded bondholders to swap their bonds for stocks in the South Sea Company, which was expected to get rich off the growth of industry of its day, the African slave trade. By the time the South Sea bubble collapsed, the government had indeed paid off its war debt, and speculators were left holding worthless, quote, growth sector stocks. In 1716, John Law organized France's Mississippi bubble along the same lines, retiring France's public debt by selling shares to create slave-stocked plantations in the Louisiana territories. It worked for a while. The U.S. government is now attempting to run the same kind of scam. Bush would like to persuade Social Security claimants to exchange the security of U.S. Treasury bonds for a chance to buy growth stocks on which a much higher return is hoped for. No modern blue sky venture comparable to the South Sea or Mississippi companies is needed. The stock market itself has become a bubble, borne aloft from the burden of generating actual goods and services by a constant flow of new retirement dollars. There is no denying that channeling trillions of Social Security dollars into the stock market would produce short-term gains. But once the money is spent, the markets are likely to retreat. This is what happens after a financial bubble. Then we will be back to where we are today, only much the poorer, with no guaranteed pension system for elderly Americans who will, of course, need guaranteed pensions more than ever as they watch their stock holdings continue to shed value. Indeed, many other countries are just now recovering from their own dismal experiences with what Augusto Pinochet and Margaret Thatcher called labor capitalism, and Bush calls, with no apparent irony, an ownership society. In the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes urged governments to run budget deficits in order to increase the economy's spending power on goods and services. His point of reference was the real economy, the economy of production and consumption, of investment in capital and in labor to operate that capital. Whereas Keynes spoke of governments priming the pump with public spending programs to get domestic investment and employment going, Bush now seeks to prime the stock market pump with Social Security contributions. It is the next natural step from our real economy to the economy of dreams. I've been reading Why Social Security Won't Be Enough to Save Wall Street by Dr. Michael Hudson. Hudson is Distinguished Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and the author of many books on international and domestic finance, including Super Imperialism, The Origin and Fundamentals of U.S. World Dominance. You can download MP3s of all our programs or contact us with questions and comments about the show at our website, www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.